Saving and everything for your next project now at Menards. Breathe easier with Best Air Ultimate Allergen Air Filters. They trap large airborne particles to keep allergens out of your home, and they last up to 90 days. Save big on all Best Air products at Menards and refresh your home today. View our selection of air filtration products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find great deals happening now. Save big.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide, recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. The Rainbow Gathering promises freedom, a place where strangers become family, where the rules of the outside world fall away and the road ahead feels endless. In the summer of 2018, 18-year-old Amber Robinson followed that promise into the woods of Georgia. She was young, curious, and chasing connection. At the gathering, she met a man. When the drums faded and the camp dispersed, the two left together, hitchhiking toward whatever came next. But Amber never made it home. Days later, her life would end violently in a stranger's house hundreds of miles away. A journey meant for peace became something far darker. Today, we'll follow Amber's last trip and ask what happens when trust meets the wrong person. If you're trying to understand how someone like Amber Robinson, a young woman who grew up without a family she could rely on, might have felt drawn to the Rainbow family, you have to start with what the Rainbow family claims to be and what it feels like to be there. Now, I attended the National Rainbow Gathering at the Ochoco National Forest in Oregon in 1997, and it's something I'll never forget. I felt included, loved, and special from the moment I arrived. Walking in, everyone you see says, "Welcome home," and they mean it. You're transported right into what you think the 1960s and the Summer of Love was all about. You meet the most amazing people with ideas and dreams beyond your wildest imagination. The Rainbow Family of Living Light is what you might call a counterculture relic, a spiritual cousin to Woodstock and the 1960s dream of peace and love. It began as a spontaneous experiment in community, born out of the Vortex Gathering in Oregon in 1970. The first official Rainbow Family Gathering took place on the Continental Divide in Colorado in 1972. That gathering, born of idealism and a desire to create a temporary community in the woods, was large enough that authorities initially tried to block it, only to stand down when thousands of people arrived anyway. What makes the Rainbow Family unique and what attracts people like Amber is what it rejects. It rejects hierarchy, formal leadership, commerce, structure, and formal membership. There are no leaders, no dues, no gatekeepers. Just a consensus culture where people are encouraged to take care of each other, share food in communal kitchens, and live lightly on the earth. At its heart, a rainbow gathering is meant to be an antidote to what many feel is a cold, isolating commercial world. Living outdoors, sharing resources, celebrating music and art, and engaging in prayer or meditation for peace. It's a celebration of belonging that is meant to be open to all, brothers, sisters, sibling, and especially attractive to people who feel untethered, unheard, unseen, or alone. It's not hard to imagine how a young person who grew up in foster care, who never had stable roots or a family that stayed, would hear that call. A place where you're welcomed without question, a place where community is spelled out loud with drum circles and shared meals around a fire in the woods. A place that calls itself family. And for someone like Amber, who told her friends she wanted to feel cared for, grounded in something real, it must have felt like the promise of home. But ideals and reality don't always move together. The Rainbow Family preaches peace, love, respect for the earth, and commitment to nonviolence. Its informal mini-manual urges participants to walk lightly, care for each other, and reject violence in all forms. But everyone is welcomed. Everyone. And without formal structure or accountability, without leadership or rules that can be enforced, the gatherings are subject to the same human contradictions that exist everywhere else in the world. Now, over the past 5 decades, the Rainbow Gatherings have been celebrated and criticized in equal measure. For every person who speaks of meditation circles, communal kitchens, and shared songs under starry skies, there are stories of poor sanitation, environmental damage, and clashes with law enforcement once the crowds get large enough. National Forest officials have documented instances of illegal drug use, traffic violations, resistance to authorities, and ecological strain on public lands used without formal permits. And there are also darker shadows in the history of these gatherings. Rare, but real incidents of violence and tragedy. In the 1980s, 2 young women were shot to death near a gathering in West Virginia. And that case would become part of a long-held mystery. Now, other years have seen non-fatal stabbings, disappearances, and other serious crimes that local law enforcement ultimately connected back to the gatherings years later. In the year I was there, a man was accused of molesting a child. He was caught, tied up to a tree, and found guilty without an adequate trial. His punishment? He was given the equivalent of a sheet of acid all at once, and let loose into the woods. And I don't know what happened to him after that. People within the Rainbow Family take care of each other. There are criminals and crime in every corner of the world, including gatherings meant to be peaceful. There's a subtle contradiction at the heart of it all. The idea that everyone belongs, paired with the reality that everyone there is safe. People drifting off the margins of society, people carrying pain, trauma, addiction, unresolved violence, can also be drawn to these places because they promise acceptance without judgment. For every person whose heart is full of hope and fraternity, there are others whose demons travel with them like shadows on a summer afternoon. It's not that the gatherings cause violence. It's that in the absence of structure, accountability, and clear boundaries, bad things that exist in the world can find a home even in a place built on peace. As one longtime attendee once said, sometimes the crowd changes, and it brings with it people who were never part of the dream in the first place. For a young woman like Amber, someone who believed in connection and belonging, the Rainbow Gathering was more than an event. It was hope, a chance to feel seen. A chance to belong to something bigger than the foster homes she had left behind. She saw in the rainbow the unfinished promise of her own life, color, connection, and the unknown road ahead. And that's why her story cuts so deep. Because we're left to wonder how a place meant to be a refuge, a community of peace, could also be the beginning of a path that would lead to such heartbreak. That contradiction sits at the center of what the Rainbow Family means to many people, and why it still carries the allure it does, even as it carries all the complexity and messiness of human life. But to understand how this story unfolded, we have to step away from the gathering and look closely at the 2 lives who crossed paths there. Amber Robinson was born on January 16, 2000, a young woman whose life was defined by movement, resilience, creativity, and an unquenchable thirst for connection. Though she didn't know her birth parents for much of her life, Amber shared a deep bond with her 4 siblings. They grounded her through years of uncertainty. She moved often between Texas, Alabama, and Florida, living in foster care from an early age. The road she traveled before adulthood was rough and fractured, shaped by repeated victimization, the kind of raw deal that leaves deep echoes in a young heart. Yet through it all, Amber carried a light within her that many who met her described as dazzling. When she was in eighth grade, one of the rarest joys of her childhood came during her time with her grandfather, Andrew Tyson, in Birmingham, Alabama. There, in his home and studio, they shared a bond over art. Hours spent painting, drawing, talking, discovering beauty in the small details of the world. At 15, Amber's life brought her to a group home in Northwest Florida, where she met a young woman named Amy Elliott. Amber had an adoption planned that ultimately fell through when that family's own life was upended, their children removed, and their hope dissolved. In 2017, Amy became Amber's emergency foster placement, welcoming her into her home and into something closer to stability than Amber had known in years. They lived together for most of that year. Amber even asked Amy to adopt her, but then changed her mind not out of rejection, but out of love for her siblings. She didn't want the legal ties that connected her to her biological family severed forever. As she neared the end of high school, Amber found a friendship that would shape some of her last months. She met Jacob Brandau at the small alternative school at Santa Rosa High in Milton, Florida, right there near the Alabama line. Amber didn't have a steady home at the time. She was bouncing from couch to couch. And Jacob let her stay with him for a few days, against his parents' wishes. They shared long evenings on his back porch, talking about life, love, philosophy, and dreams. They took mushrooms, watched documentaries, and stared out at the lake behind the house. Jacob felt something like romantic tension between them, but Amber was still with someone else at the time. So what lingered was a sense of kinship, one kindred spirit meeting another. In the months that he knew her, Jacob saw the fire in her spirit. Amber was always talking about using networks like the Rainbow Family as a gateway to travel. She told him her older sister had been wandering on her own for a year, and it was going well. To Amber, that life seemed possible, even beautiful. The Rainbow Family Gathering, the annual convergence of free spirits, artists, and wanderers in the forests of America, that all represented freedom to her. It was where she believed she truly belonged. She was an artist, a writer, a philosopher, a mystic, and an adventurer. She loved animals, photography, reading, ukulele playing, and the outdoors. She wrote poems full of longing and reverence for life. And above all, she was a devoted sister. She believed in perseverance, in standing up for herself, and in overcoming tragedy by becoming strong and healthy. She even hoped to study mortuary sciences so that she could help grieving families find peace after losing loved ones. A desire born from empathy, not detachment. Now by mid-June 2018, Amber was ready to chase that dream of freedom. She had just aged out of the foster care system, a threshold that feels like both liberation and exposure when you've known little else. Jacob and another friend equipped her for the road. Jacob bought her a pair of Vans, and another outfitted her with a tent and camping gear. They shared a farewell dinner, laughter and nervous anticipation simmering under the surface. Jacob thought about joining her on the road himself, but in the end, he stayed behind. As she prepared for her first solo journey, Amber reached out to the online Rainbow community again and again, asking for advice and support. "I'm just scared of being alone in a place I'm not familiar with," is what she posted in a Rainbow Family Sister Circle group. Now that's honest and brave and tender. Her plan was to head north to the Rainbow Family's annual gathering in the Chattahoochee National Forest in Georgia to drink in the drum circles, art, and connection she had dreamed about since she was a teenager. So by June 18th, she was buzzing with excitement. "I can't wait to meet so many people at Rainbow," she wrote in a Facebook group. "I'm excited to come home." It was there, amid the green shade and open hearts of the Counterculture Festival, that Amber crossed paths with Joseph Shaggy Capstraw, a name that would, in the weeks that followed, warp her story into something dark and devastating. The exact moment they met isn't certain. Some believe it was at the gathering itself, others think it might have been a couple days earlier at a bus stop. What's clear is that they shared music and instruments, Amber's ukulele, Joseph's guitar, and a connection rooted in wanderlust. Joseph Capstraw, known as Shaggy, was himself a product of hardship. He had begun hitchhiking 2 years earlier, after aging out of foster care at 18. He was a train hopper, a street musician, a wanderer who'd spent years on the fringes, often among the so-called train jumpers or crust punks, which are transient communities that lived rough, unanchored, and outside conventional society. Now, friends and past partners described him as enigmatic, charming at times, warm on the surface, but with a darker interior that revealed itself when he drank or in moments of stress. There were stories of violence in his past, including a 2017 brawl in Jacksonville, Florida, where he stabbed another man, an incident that culminated in an attempted murder charge, later dropped when witnesses said he acted in self-defense. But even among some members of the Rainbow family, there were murmurs of concern about him. And when Amber and Joseph left the gathering together around June 25th, she seemed excited about the open road and the possibility of a life shared with this road dog Shaggy, as she called him. But the road had dangers Amber couldn't have foreseen. What began as hopeful music and shared laughter soon spiraled into tragedy. Amber's messages grew quieter, her circle grew smaller, and the life she imagined began to narrow. Let's follow Amber Robinson into her final days.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for the New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's the Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.
After the Rainbow Gathering ended, Amber Robinson stepped back onto the road, believing she was finally living the life she'd imagined for years. She and Joseph made plans to hitchhike together. Every state, no deadline, no final destination. Music would be their currency. On sidewalks and street corners, Amber with her ukulele and Joseph with his guitar, they busked for spare change. Some days they made just enough to eat. Other days they made enough for a cheap motel, a hot shower, a locked door, a moment of rest. For Amber, this wasn't reckless. It was independence. It was movement. It was proof that she could survive on her own terms. The two were hitchhiking along a highway near Louisville, Kentucky, when a stranger named Jacob Barnes, traveling with his friend Levi, stopped and offered them a ride. Amber and Joseph accepted. And when Jacob realized they had nowhere to sleep that night, he extended what must have felt to Amber like a small mercy. It was an offer to stay at his home in Elizabethtown in Hardin County, Kentucky. Before arriving, the group stopped at a nearby gas station where they picked up another woman, Amber No. Now, at first, everything felt safe. They were having fun, partying, and meeting new people. Amber texted friends that she had cleaned the house, and Joseph helped Jacob clear fallen trees from the yard. Jacob agreed to pay them a small amount so they could afford bus tickets. Now, it certainly wasn't glamorous, but it was stable, however temporary. So they decided to stay for several days, And during that time, something inside Amber shifted. And she confided in Jacob Brandau, the friend she trusted most. She told him she was planning to leave Joseph, that she wanted to go to Texas, then California, alone. She talked about trying to get a modeling job in Los Angeles, about growing and becoming something more than the sum of her past. On July 3rd, Amber sent Jacob a message that reads now like a quiet goodbye. I miss you, best friend. And I've walked 3 states already on foot in the shoes you gave me. You're the only person I think about when I think about feeling cared about and not alone. And about Joseph, she was honest, gentle but clear, saying, dude, I've literally tried to fall in love and I can't. I think my heart is defective. All I care about is getting to Cali and growing. Still, Amber didn't leave immediately. For reasons we can only guess at, caution, exhaustion, politeness, hope, she stayed 3 more days, until July 6th. According to testimony, when the group first arrived at Jacob's house, the atmosphere was light. They sang, they played music, Amber strummed her ukulele, laughter filled the room. Then everything narrowed. Jacob, Levi, and Amber No left the house to drive to Louisville so Amber No could buy heroin. They were gone for roughly 2 hours, leaving Amber and Joseph alone in the house. Joseph later claimed during that time, he and Amber drank nearly an entire fifth of bourbon. He said they were having a really good conversation until Amber became upset. According to him, she criticized Jacob for taking Amber No to buy drugs. An argument followed. And what happened next is where the story fractures. Joseph gave multiple conflicting accounts, but one thing remained consistent. He claimed he blacked out. Sometime between midnight and 1 a.m., Joseph left the house and began knocking on doors throughout the neighborhood, trying to get help. No one answered until he reached the home of Stephen Ginn. Stephen testified that he was asleep when loud banging woke him. When he opened the door, he saw Joseph standing on his porch covered in blood. Stephen told him to stay where he was while he woke his adult son. When they returned, Joseph was frantic, asking them to follow him. As they walked back towards Jacob's house, Joseph kept saying he had done something bad. Then, he said plainly, "I killed her." Police were already responding to calls about a man matching Joseph's description banging on doors. Sergeant Brandon Huggins and Officer Charles Fushi arrived at the scene shortly after. Stephen flagged them down and led them to Jacob's home. When Sergeant Huggins arrived, Joseph was on the ground in the front yard screaming, "Save her, save her, save her." Officer Fushi described Joseph as erratic, sweating heavily, pacing, yelling, unable to stay still. Joseph told officers that Amber had attacked him with a knife, that he blacked out, and when he came to, she was dead. But inside the house, the reality was devastating. Amber's face had been so severely damaged that investigators later had to rely on dental records to identify her. Officers observed only superficial cuts on Joseph's inner left forearm. They were already bandaged by EMTs. No other injuries were noted. Sergeant Huggins testified that Joseph smelled faintly of alcohol, although Officer Fushi did not smell alcohol and observed no clear signs of intoxication beyond Joseph's behavior. Joseph was taken into custody and interviewed by Detective Madison Kuklinski. Now, during that interview, he never directly confessed, but he made statements that hovered painfully close to the truth. "I know what I did. I guess I killed her." Then his story shifted again. He claimed Amber had judged Jacob, that she went into the kitchen, attacked him with a knife, causing the cuts on his arm. He insisted he did not cut himself. And when he later complained of pain in his hands, he was sent to the hospital and the interview ended. Now at trial, Joseph's account changed yet again. This time, he said Amber struck him in the face, that he blacked out, and when he came to, she was dead. He claimed he then retrieved a knife and attempted to kill himself, cutting his arm, because he believed Amber was already gone. He said that while cutting himself, he heard her breathing. That's when, he claimed, he ran from the house and began knocking on doors. While we may not have the truth, we know that Amber Robinson never left that house alive. Her final days, filled with hope, music, movement, and plans for a future she believed she was finally building, ended in violence she could not escape. She was only 18 years old. What really happened in that house in Elizabethtown is something we will never fully know. There are no witnesses to Amber's final moments, only shifting stories, only a body that could no longer speak for itself. In the end, the truth was filtered through police reports, courtroom testimony, and the words of the only person who survived that night. Words that changed again and again. The only thing the justice system could do was not to explain Amber's death, but to respond to it. When the case against Joseph Shaggy Capstra finally reached trial, the courtroom became the place where Amber Robinson's life and death was reduced to evidence. The person tasked with speaking for Amber's body was Dr. Jeffrey Springer, a forensic pathologist who conducted her autopsy. What he described was not ambiguous. Dr. Springer testified that Amber's cause of death was blunt force trauma and strangulation. He explained that Amber was 5'3" and weighed just 92 pounds, petite, slight, physically small. Joseph, by contrast, stood 6'3" and weighed 188 pounds. The disparity between them was impossible to ignore. One body is vulnerable, the other is powerful. Amber's toxicology report showed that her blood alcohol level was 0.093, approximately 2 hours before her death. Now, the defense would later lean heavily on intoxication, on confusion, blackout, loss of control, as an explanation. But intoxication does not explain the injuries. The jury was instructed on murder, second-degree manslaughter, and the defense of intoxication. They listened to testimony. They weighed Joseph's shifting stories. And they were shown photographs. Images that Joseph's team would later argue should never have been seen. 8 photographs in total. 4 from the autopsy and 4 from the crime scene. And they were not shown for shock value. They were shown because they told a story Amber's words could not. Now, the images documented multiple blunt force injuries to Amber's face and skull. Lacerations, abrasions, contusions. A deep vertical cut, nearly an inch long, ran between her eyebrows. Beneath it, the frontal bone of her skull was fractured. Both of Amber's eyes were blackened. Smaller cuts sat beneath them. Her nose was broken and displaced. The bone that held her upper teeth had fractured and collapsed into her mouth. One entire tooth had been knocked free and lay on the floor beside her body. Not chipped, not cracked, but whole. Detectives testified that this alone demonstrated extraordinary force. There was bruising on the right side of her neck, consistent with manual strangulation. Her left ear had been pulled away from her head. Bruising marked the back of her ear and the scalp behind it. Injuries that often appear when someone's head is forcefully grabbed or slammed. The crime scene photos showed Amber lying on her back on the living room floor, in front of the couch, surrounded by a large pool of blood. Blood and tissue spatter stained the floor and the furniture. A red foamy substance, blood mixed with air, escaped her mouth, indicating she had aspirated on her own blood while still alive. One cropped image focused on her left arm. A large, deep blue bruise bloomed on the inside of her arm, just above the elbow crease. A location, detectives testified, is commonly seen in domestic violence cases, where a victim is forcefully grabbed and restrained. The bruise had already fully developed, signaling the amount of force used. This was not a single blow. This was not an accident. This was not a moment in time. This was sustained violence. After deliberation, the jury rejected the defense's arguments. They found Joseph Capstra guilty of murder. He was sentenced to 50 years in prison. And shortly after, Joseph appealed. He argued that the admission of these 8 photographs was unfairly prejudicial, that the jury should not have been forced to see the physical reality of what he did, that the images were too graphic, too disturbing, and too powerful. But thankfully, the appellate courts disagreed. The photographs were relevant, they were accurate, and they are necessary. So the verdict was upheld. Today, Joseph Capstra remains incarcerated at Lee Adjustment Center in Bettyville, Kentucky, with a parole eligibility date of June 2038. He will not walk free for decades, if ever. And yet, no sentence can answer the questions that linger. We will never know exactly what Amber experienced in her final moments. We will never hear her voice explaining what she felt, what she feared, what she tried to do to survive. We will never know the life she might have built, the art she would have created, the places she would have traveled, the people she would have loved. Amber could have been anything. She talked about healing families through mortuary science. She dreamed of California. She wrote poetry. She loved music, animals, and the outdoors. She could have saved lives. She could have raised children, and she could have grown old. All that was taken in one night, in one house, through the violent choices of one person. And while Joseph's incarceration prevents him from destroying more lives, it does not restore what was lost. At the end of this story, there is no clean justice. 2 young lives, both shaped by foster care, instability, trauma, collided in the worst possible way. One ended. One will now be defined forever by that ending. So the question remains, heavy and unresolved. Where is the justice in that? Perhaps the harder question still. Did we fail them both long before that night ever came? Before we leave Amber's story behind, it feels important to pause, not in fear, but in care. Because the truth is, people will continue going to rainbow gatherings. They'll continue to feel called to the woods, to the drums, to the idea of a temporary family made of strangers. And for many people, those gatherings are peaceful, meaningful, even healing. Amber didn't go to the rainbow looking for danger. She went for connection. So if you're listening to this and you've ever felt that same pull, or if you're planning to go to a rainbow gathering yourself, this part is for you. First, what do you need to bring? Rainbow gatherings happen far from towns, stores, or services. You are responsible for yourself in ways that can feel liberating and overwhelming. Bring enough food and water for several days, even if you plan to eat at communal kitchens. Bring a tent that can handle rain, warm layers for nighttime, sunscreen, bug spray, headlamp, first aid kit, any medications you need, extra, not just enough. Bring sturdy shoes you can walk miles in. Bring cash and a credit card to get there and back. But the gathering itself does not use money. So if you want or need something while you're there, you need to bring something to trade. There are trading circles in each gathering. People trade for food, drugs, musical instruments, clothing, literally anything you could imagine. And although your phone likely won't work while you're there, be sure to bring a charged phone, charger, plus a backup battery, even if you plan to stay off-grid. Now, second, you need to get there safely. Hitchhiking has always been a part of rainbow culture. But it's also one of the most dangerous parts of the journey, especially for young people traveling alone. If you choose to hitchhike, trust your instincts immediately. If something feels off, anything, it probably is. Share your plans with someone you trust. Send photos of license plates. Keep your location on. Arrange check-ins. And know this, you never owe anyone anything. Not a ride, not a conversation, not gratitude or loyalty. just because they helped you once. Third, substances and boundaries. Now, rainbow gatherings are often associated with drugs. Psychedelics, alcohol, marijuana, and harder drugs. Some people partake, some don't. It's just like the rest of the world. What matters is this. You are safest when you stay clear-headed. Substances lower your ability to read danger, leave situations quickly, or advocate for yourself. You do not have to take anything offered to you. Not to fit in, not to be polite, and certainly not to be spiritual enough. Anyone who pressures you to use drugs, drink excessively, or isolate yourself is not acting in your best interest. And fourth is how you deal with people. Now, most people at the Rainbow are kind. Some are deeply generous. But not everyone there is safe. And that's not a failure of the idea of Rainbow. It's a reality of humanity. So stay connected to groups. Avoid disappearing alone with someone you just met, even if you think you know them. Be cautious about forming intense bonds very quickly. Watch how people treat others, especially women, especially when alcohol is involved. If someone is aggressive, controlling, or dismissive of your boundaries, walk away. There are safer spaces. There are people there who will help you. And you don't need permission to leave any situation. Rainbow is built on respect for the land and for each other. Pack out what you pack in. Help in the kitchens if you eat there. Listen more than you talk. Don't take photos without consent. Honor quiet spaces. Be gentle. Be accountable. Community only works when everyone protects it. And finally, listen to yourself. Amber trusted deeply. She believed in goodness. Those are not flaws. They are beautiful qualities. But the world does not always meet kindness with care. If something doesn't feel right, if a plan starts to change, if a person becomes someone else, if your body tightens with fear, that's information. Take it seriously. Leaving is not failure. Choosing yourself is not selfish, and survival is not weakness. Amber went to Rainbow because she wanted to belong, because she wanted to feel free, because she believed the world could be kind. Her story isn't a warning against connection. It's a reminder that connection should never cost you your safety. If you go to Rainbow, go prepared, go supported, go aware, and come home. Because your life, like Amber's, is worth protecting. Amber Robinson was not reckless. She was not naive. She was not asking for what happened to her. She was a young woman who believed in connection, who believed that the world could be gentler than the life she had been given. She believed in art and music and open roads. She believed that family could be found, even if you weren't born into one. Her story is not just about a crime. It's about longing. It's about what happens when people grow up without safety and go searching for it in places that promise belonging. Joseph Capstra has been held legally accountable. He'll spend decades behind bars. But no verdict can return what was taken. The life Amber never got to live, the woman she was still becoming. If there's anything to carry forward from this story, let it be this. Trust and freedom should never require you to sacrifice your safety. Community should protect its most vulnerable. And young people who grow up without families deserve more than survival. They deserve care, guidance, and protection. Amber deserved a future. She deserved love without fear. She deserved to come home. If you or someone you love is traveling alone, feeling untethered, or searching for belonging, please know that help exists, that safety matters, and that choosing yourself is always allowed. Thank you for listening and holding Amber's story with care. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.